Good evening. Delighted to have you here. Tonight we've got Diane Carey, who is a Star Trek writer, many of the series, and she's going to speak to us a little bit about science fiction and what is it? Who cares? So without any other comment, I'll let Diane take over.
The science fiction, what's the point? That's the great fight over how to entitle your work. I kind of tailored this for both readers and writers, so everybody should be able to get something out of it. I have, my husband Greg Broder and I have written 44, I think, at last count, novels. Believe it, after a while you do lose track. 20 or 29, 30 are Star Trek books. We were Star Trek's best-selling authors there for quite a while, and we did many anchor books and had a good time and made a good living keeping alive a 30-plus-year-old property, which has its own challenges. But it is, in venue, a science fiction type of story, so we're going to talk about that kind of thing. I'm going to begin with what science fiction is not. Science fiction is not racing around in spaceships instead of fast cars or sailing ships. Now, some of you may know that I actually work on sailing ships, so when I talk about ships, I know what I'm talking about. I work on several of the tall ships that we've seen floating around Michigan and the East Coast and West Coast. And I work under real captains with real crews, real shipmates, and real storms, real problems. And anyway, if the story can be transferred to a fast car or a sailing ship and nothing changes, then you haven't made good science fiction. If your protagonists are not affected in their character arc by advanced technology, then you haven't made good science fiction. A character arc is how a character changes from the beginning of the work to the end because of what happens to him. He can't just change because he grows up. That's not a dramatic change. If the character arc would happen anyway, without the story elements occurring around him, then it's not drama, it's just ordinary life. Drama is not ordinary life. It's a series of seemingly random events, which are in fact decidedly non-random, and carefully crafted to exact a certain awareness or reaction from the audience. Most good writing is actually crafted from the end back to the beginning, and not the other way around. Anyone who writes a story just by starting at one point and so-called letting the story happen isn't really writing, he's just wandering with a keyboard in front of him. Good writing is much more architecture than it is art. Notice that I said good writing. You'll hear the term good writing or good science fiction, and quite a bit tonight, and when you hear it, know that I mean something specific. Now, back to what is not science fiction. Science fiction is not fantasy. If the strongest force is magic, then you have fantasy and not science fiction. If the characters are chasing around after a giant ruby imbued with undefined energies or powers, then you've got fantasy. For instance, Star Wars is not science fiction. It's fantasy. The main force is the force, which is never defined and has no rules or limitations. Superman is the same. When he needs to be stronger, he somehow attains more strength than ever before, and the envelope is constantly more elastic. Batman is actually more science fiction than Superman because Batman is an ordinary human being who uses technology to become superhuman. In Star Wars, despite the spaceships, notice I'm saying Star Wars and not Star Trek, don't get confused. I'm not confused yet, so bear along with me. I am talking about Star Wars. Despite the spaceships and the ray guns and the lightsaber, which, by the way, is pretty good science fiction, the Force does basically whatever the writers need it to do, need to have happen at the moment. In good science fiction, the Force would be a scientifically plausible, and it would be clearly defined, and it would have limitations, which would have to be expanded by the protagonist's own personal cleverness or growing wisdom. In good science fiction, the science doesn't do whatever the writers needed to do at the time. It's more or less the other way around. Even George Lucas had no idea what he was going for. The Force went from being a mystical tool of sheer will which apparently could be inherited, which is definitely not science fiction, to being a trick of levitation, to finally being nothing at all when the writers wanted, hi, welcome, come aboard, wanted Luke Skywalker to have to drag his father's body across the floor instead of just floating him out of danger. The Force turned out to be an unhelpful, dramatic dead end. So it was dropped like a hot phaser. So good science fiction doesn't have magic. If something appears to be magical in science fiction, it will turn out to be scientifically based. And therefore, it can be learned and controlled by anybody with the patience and the will to learn. Just as an aside, there's also good fantasy and bad fantasy. We're all overdosed on Lord of the Rings, which remains bad fantasy because every time we turn around, there's a sword of this or a shirt of that or a mountain of this or a light of them that gives instant power to the bearer. Like the Force, we never even know what the dang power of the ring is. And it turns out to be nothing but a way to become invisible. And so what? However, Lord of the Rings is also excellent fantasy because the heroes are the only people who have no power at all, the hobbits. The hobbits live in a world dripping with magical powers and mystical forces, and we travel with them through these vortices of unpredictable grandeur and horror, and yet, though outmatched at every turn, they keep on going. Victory wasn't won by Gandalf with his wizardry, or by Aragorn with his hereditary title, or his army, or his not-so-subtle duplicate of Excalibur, nor by the elves with their undefined ability to channel the powers of nature. Victory is won by the smallest and the weakest beings who can't even ride a horse by themselves, because they had the inner constitution to carry on through the worst of adversity for a singular goal. That, friends, is excellent writing. And what makes it excellent is not the power, but the weakness. Good science fiction is not necessarily the examining of alien cultures. Remember, we're still on what science fiction is not. Nor is it the interaction of humans with aliens. Science fiction is not Spock's pointed ears. We know it's not, because if we file his ears down, he's still a pretty interesting guy. And when he's on the scene, we can't help but watch him. He was upstaged only by the commanding, and no pun intended, presence of James Kirk. A character who can upstage Spock, you have to admit, is a very compelling and magnetic personality. And again, he is the person with the least inherent power. Whatever James Kirk has, he earned mostly the hard way. I know, because they asked me to write the books about James Kirk as a young boy, so I dragged him through hell. That's my favorite thing. What can I do to really ruin this person's day? So, James Kirk was a commander because of his own inner strengths and weaknesses, which we'll get to in a minute. Not because he was physically stronger or had telepathy or unlimited knowledge or scientific brilliance, but because he could make the leaps of logic which were beyond Spock's personal daring. Spock and the Vulcans of the original series were fascinating not because they were devoid of emotion like computers with legs, but because they were so highly emotional that they were in fact out of control and had to find a way to cage their emotions or face extinction. A creature that really has no emotions is boring. Vulcans were interesting because the emotions were clearly there, but either stifled or ignored, often at great cost. That's what made Spock a compelling character. Not how much he was unlike human beings, but how much he was like us, but fought it. In true dramatic foil, James Kirk didn't fight it. He went with it. And we had to watch him. An alien culture in good science fiction is not achieved by eating differently than we do, or by gluing scales to a human actor's forehead and making stupid rules like this race cannot tell a lie. That's idiotic. If they cannot tell a lie, there had better be a darn good reason. If they won't tell a lie, that's a whole other element, and it has to be dealt with. For instance, my husband and co-author, Greg Broder, and I are working on a story now with aliens who can't lie, because when they do, they actually turn colors. As a result, they don't trust humans at all, because we can lie without an outward broadcast. The fact that they got no poker face isn't the story, because who cares? It's how humans have to interact with creatures who don't dare trust us that makes the science fiction story. If we want to experience an alien culture that's just culturally different from us, all we have to do is go to China or Morocco or Canada. Ordinary cultural differences make a good travelogue, but they don't make good science fiction. In truly good science fiction, an alien culture must have evolved in such an environment as to be greatly affected by the science of their environment. Dolphins, for instance. But dolphins aren't good science fiction because they haven't conquered their environment science. They just adjusted to it by growing fins. And they can't control or alter their environment. By adjusting to their environment, they gave up science because they gave up having opposable thumbs. When a dolphin can build a bridge, then maybe you got science fiction. A good alien culture, for dramatic purposes, is not a bunch of giants with different skin than we have. They have to be giant for a reason. Something to do with their planet's gravity, maybe. And then we have to see how having different gravity affected their science, because physics doesn't just change on a whim. There's a reason tarantulas the size of airplanes don't exist. It's because nature knows how big is too big to carry its own weight. That's why we don't have giant bugs, and why we win if we come up against them, because they can't walk. they can't exist. Nature knows what the tricks are. We've achieved those things. Iron molecules, for instance, have to be a certain size with certain properties, and the gravity has to be right in order to build with it. So the beings doing the building have to have the senses at one end and the propulsion at the other, and some kind of a hand that will dig iron out of the ground. A creature with no hand will never build a pencil, never mind a spaceship. They also have to have a cooperative society, so somebody can be growing the food to feed the builders. Stonehenge is a good example of ancient science fiction. How are we going to get these 5-ton stones carved to very specific curvatures, then lift them 20 feet in the air and create a 100-foot diameter stone ring that's level to the ground, level to within an inch on slanted ground? 5,000 years ago. We can barely do it today, and they did it then. Well, they also had to still manage to feed the people who were doing the architecture and the building. They had to cooperate. It was technology and cultural organization, not aliens and not druid magic. The druids didn't have any magic. They just wanted people to think they did, because that guaranteed them respect and fear and regular bed and breakfast. And Stonehenge, by the way, predated the druids by a couple of thousand years. So science fiction can be where you find it. Sometimes it's 5,000 years ago. Greg and I, well, mostly Greg, developed a whole culture of refugees who lived on a planet made entirely of metal. That's really dopey. I know, because that was my idea. I was watching a commercial, and this car was driving across a molten planet, and I said, that's really cool. I can describe that. Let's do that. And Spock, my husband, said, that can't be, that's impossible. It can't exist because of this and this and this and this and this. And being the Kirk clone of our marriage, I said, I don't care, make it happen. Well, the more I talked, the more he sat around and thought about how that could happen. So in alternate universes, you can play with things like that, and it's totally goofy and impossible. We did it anyway. Obviously, these people can't live on a planet made of metal. Nothing can. So the planet managed to have an atmosphere, and in the atmosphere there was life, because the planet itself couldn't have any life. So there were these big blimp-like creatures living in the atmosphere, and the refugees on the planet had learned to hunt them. And the only way to hunt them was to provide bait. And the only bait was living organisms, so they had to sacrifice a few of their own tribe whenever they wanted to catch food. That meant they had to grow a culture which would not only allow such brutality, but encourage it. They had a whole system of leadership structure which was set up to flex if one of their leaders ended up being eaten by one of the blimpy creatures, because that happened often enough to worry about. So they adjusted to their scientifically hostile environment, but they also forced their environment to adjust to them by using science in their favor. What they had stuck to their foreheads didn't matter, because costuming doesn't matter. What mattered was that they lived in an environment ruled by a certain science, and that they forced the science to work in a particular way for particular ends. That's good science fiction, and that's a good alien culture. Because it really is aliens, and not just humans in costumes who look down their noses at us. Another thing good science fiction is not is CGI, special effects. We have been in love with ourselves ever since we first saw the Imperial ship wedge its way out of the top of our movie screen and keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. All of a sudden, we were in love with what technology could do on the movie screen. I'll never forget that moment. I don't think anybody will. We have achieved a visual mastery of wide and small screen that is phenomenal and unimagined by previous generations of science fiction writers and readers and viewers. I remember when the glittering image of the blob-like creature called the Companion on Star Trek garnered award nominations because of its special effects. Remember that? It was on the cover of TV Guide, if I recall. Why, then, would we look at that and say, well, that's just painfully cheesy today, and yet the episode is still very watchable? Well, it's because the story didn't depend on the glitter. The story wasn't the special effect. The story was something else. So ask yourself, what CGI did H.G. Wells have going for him? Well, none at all. What CGI do I have going for me in my 30 or so science fiction novels? Absolutely none. I have black ink and white paper, same as H.G. Wells, same as Socrates, same as the scribes of medieval times, because the best CGI is still the open mind of the reader. So CGI is fun, but it doesn't matter to a good science fiction story. I liked watching The Polar Express. It was pretty, but I wanted more story. You know, I like Van Helsing because the special effects were cool, but I like the characters better. You know, if the characters aren't there and the story isn't there, eventually you stop watching it. So we're down to having eliminated what science fiction is not, unless you can think of anything else, Greg, what science fiction isn't. Okay, here's what good science fiction is. Science fiction as drama is a very specific genre. In good science fiction, the science is good. The technology has to be riveted to real science, an extrapolation of what we know. It's particularly bad science fiction when a newly discovered alien culture from a sector 8,000 light years away from Earth happens to speak English. I find that very silly and annoying, and I always try to work around it. With me, there's always a translator, or the aliens have had a chance to learn enough English to get by. There's always some way. It's small, but it matters to me, because it blows the illusion. So I always kind of go for that sort of thing. The most important element in good science fiction, and if you're taking notes, write this one down. It can't happen in any other venue. The second most important element is that the protagonist or protagonists, the main characters, are affected by the science. The third element is that they affect the drama somehow by controlling the science. If those three factors can be crafted into a story, you've got a pretty good science fiction, or at least the beginning of it. For instance, anybody out there remember the story about the little girl who stowed away on the supply ship which was headed out to resupply her brother's encampment. I can't remember the title of it, but it's like a mainstay of science fiction. Do you remember the title? Cold Equations. I think you're right. This little girl stowed away aboard a supply ship in space, driven by one pilot. And she was driven by love for her brother, and she wanted to surprise him with a visit. We had pure human motivation clashing with hard scientific reality. They were in a futuristic enough environment that every last gram of weight in the ship had been perfectly balanced and could not be altered without a disaster. And I'm technological enough to be able to work a piece of paper there. Now, I've worked on sailing ships for years, and a ton this way or that way doesn't make a difference. We'll work with it. We'll adjust. On this space supply craft, everything had been measured and calculated down to the last possible measure of weight. The ship couldn't land carrying the excess weight of the skinny little girl. Dozens of lives depended on its landing. The pilot couldn't leave because he was the only one who could land the ship. He contemplated jumping out himself, but there was no remote. The science element of the story was in the perfect lack of flexibility. The main character, the pilot, is faced with this horrible choice. Sacrifice this girl or sacrifice all the lives on the planet. Now, we've been trained through years of fiction to believe there's a way out of every situation and we're going to find a happy ending. But in this case, you know what? There wasn't. The drama came from the struggle to discover a solution and the courage of sacrifice when there wasn't a solution. They actually jettisoned the girl out the airlock. And nobody who reads that story can forget it. It's absolutely shocking. And in tears, the pilot lands the craft. It's incredible. As we travel this terrible road that the pilot and the brother and the others involved would never forget the awful consequences of measuring their science down to a no alternatives perfection. The bad guy was the scientific perfection they had attained, and the character flaw was in factoring out the human element of spontaneity and surprise. Whopping good science fiction. No special effects, and it was great, and you can't forget it. You'll never forget it after tonight. You'll go read it. My other favorite example of excellent, pure, true science fiction is the Star Trek episode, The Enemy Within. Remember that? Yeah. Because it's hard to forget. William Shatner is commonly spoofed, and he even spoofs himself for his acting and his spastic overacting. But we only spoof what impresses us, and in this episode, he was absolutely brilliant. He used his talents, which are considerable, to communicate every scintilla of passion, fear, and consequence invited by a beautifully crafted storyline. The story in The Enemy Within is almost dramatically perfect. James Kirk steps into the transporter, and unbeknownst to anyone at first, he is divided into two beings, a good Captain Kirk and an evil Captain Kirk. His psychological personality is cut in half and rebuilt into two human beings. He is the everyman, the quintessential human adventure hero, the most fascinating creature in the universe, because humans are always the most fascinating. This wouldn't have worked with Spock. It wouldn't have worked with Dr. McCoy or Engineer Scott. They'd go babble in a corner. It would only work with a complex character who had command because he was complex and because this story examined what makes him a dramatic hero and a real human hero. The religious idea of humanity is always the struggle between good and evil, and the goal is to totally eradicate evil, right? We see that all the time. Because if we could eradicate evil, we would have a perfect world of peace and happiness. Or would we? Only through science fiction can we examine this premise. Only the transporter can cleanly excise James Kirk's bad side and leave his good side walking around free, carrying the wisdom, decency, empathy, and gentility of a truly good human being, without being encumbered by blind aggression, selfishness, greed, and cruelty of his bad side. Sounds great. Wouldn't the world be wondrous if we could just zap away all human negative characteristics? Now, admittedly, some people are so far gone that only the death penalty will solve the problem of their existence. Others are so painfully good that they can't get anything important done in life. We're not talking about extremes of humanity, but of the basic human being as embodied by Jim Kirk, a good scout, a loyal friend, and a hell of a warrior. Now, without our passions, would we have our curiosity? Without our self-interest, would we have our drive toward discovery? James Kirk the Good begins to weaken. Shatner acted down to the level of weakness. His voice got quieter. He had no drive. He could barely raise his arms. There was nothing motivating him, while his counterpart acted up to a level of intensity. He did what's called selling it. I appreciated the acting job in that episode. The good James Kirk can't make command decisions anymore. He loses the will to save the lives of his landing party, who are trapped on a frozen planet because of the broken transporter. Our technology comes back to haunt us. He can't think aggressively or even clearly anymore. He's turning into a monk. When Dr. McCoy points out that the evil Kirk has the will and the power of command and the strength of character to make hard decisions and the drive to survive and prevail, the good Kirk asks, fearfully, "What do I have?" They find that he has the wisdom to control his evil side, to force its brazen strength to work toward the good, and that he can't accomplish much without his evil edge. He could never be a leader without it. We look around humanity and discover that's probably true about all our greatest leaders. Abraham Lincoln, generally regarded as wise, compassionate, and gentle, found it within himself to send hundreds of thousands of boys to their certain deaths and to watch their coffins being transported by the hundreds past the White House. Ulysses Grant, who so empathized with his men that he wore a private's shirt instead of a general's uniform, treated men like ants and just kept sending more and more and more to their deaths until finally he overwhelmed the enemy with sheer numbers. Why? Because ending the war sooner than later, with more casualties, would save more lives than he was sacrificing. Alexander the Great would have been less great if he had simply conquered other lands and decimated their people and their cultures. His greatness came in the fact that he amalgamated those cultures. He married their girls off to his troops. He brought those cultures in and absorbed them rather than destroying them. He knew when to fight, and he knew when to stop fighting. That's the difference between a great leader and a barbarous pig with power like Stalin. The same goes for the atom bomb. Wasn't it Truman, President Truman, who dropped the bomb on Japan with horrifying loss of life? But it stopped an enemy which was prepared to fight to the last boy. That didn't happen because Truman was a bad, evil person, but because he was a good person with tremendous strength who saw reality for what it was. And he knew that good doesn't necessarily conquer evil. Sometimes evil conquers evil. And that's what James Kirk learned when he found out that he couldn't live and command without his evil side. Because that's where his power came from. That's where his strength came from. It's where he got the resolve to make the hardest decisions of his life, in which a good commander has to choose between a wrong and a wrong. Because life isn't choosing between right and wrong. That's easy. You choose right. Sometimes we have to choose between two wrongs and bend toward a good outcome. What made James Kirk a great leader was his evil side, the strong, angry, ferocious, brutal beast, controlled by the wisdom of understanding not how we fight, but why we fight. His good side, even though separated in a completely different physical body, in the end, had to use the force of will to subdue his evil self and force it to comply. Even in his weakness, the good side had the will to make evil go his way. He did that not by vanquishing his evil side, but by accepting it. It worked very well. But he was left, this is the character arc I told you about, he was left with the haunting knowledge that that evil was inside him. And it was part of him, and he couldn't get along without it. Ooh, it's a good story. Go watch it. You'll like it. That story about James Kirk is the ultimate human leader enduring the ultimate test of leadership, and it could only happen in a science fiction story. It's almost perfect science fiction, and the acting, by the way, was superior. I suggest you all go look at it. Watch that show. Now, Greg and I hope this doesn't sound not the way I intended, but Greg and I always try to write good science fiction along the lines of good, the way I've defined it over the past few minutes. That's not a compliment to ourselves. That's the way we work. It's like a doctor always trying to make the best outcome for every patient, no matter how many patients he's treated, or an architect always trying to build a better bridge. I am never complacent or full of myself, no matter how many contracts are sent my way. I always sit down on the other side of the table from my brilliant husband and say, what is the element of this story that cannot happen in any other venue? And what makes this story worth reading? We don't progress until we find that key. If it's a historical story, what is it about its place in history that can't be told in any other time period? If it's a young adult story with teenagers or kids, what is it about the story that would be wrecked if the protagonists were grown-ups? I'm always interested in the characters who have the least power, not the most, because they have to force the powerful elements around them to do what they want. If I have a powerful character like a starship captain to deal with, which I did through many assignments, he's automatically a dramatic problem because he has ultimate power on his ship. A very powerful ship, by the way. The first thing I want to do is stick him in a situation where the sheer physical strength of his ship and his command authority won't help much. But because of his command, he's forced to be the one to make the decisions. If he can just phaser his way out, that's not good writing. The best James Kirk stories, or any other action hero, protagonist stories, dramatic stories, are those in which the hero is stuck with the responsibility to subdue some entity with more powerful than he has, with more power. And it always works. It always works. I've never had it fail. You put your main character up against something he really has to beat with his brain and not just brawn, and you've got something good. In a book called First Frontier, it's the one with the little dinosaur on it. I know it's here. See it? Kirk and his party were transported back 65 million years to the week in which the asteroid struck the Earth and destroyed the great age of the dinosaurs. And I was very privileged to be able to describe this big rock landing on Earth. Actually, physically describe it because my characters were watching it. It was great. And a pretty big responsibility, too, because I had to get all the science right. There are certain science elements involved with a gigantic 10-mile-across rock hitting the Earth. So it had to look like it really looked, and that took a lot of research. Fortunately, I was working with Dr. Jim Kirkland, whom, if you watch any dinosaur shows, you have seen him holding the skull of the Utah raptor, and he's one of the world's foremost paleontologists. So we worked together on that. And that was some job, describing that rock hitting the Earth. So anyway, James Kirk was back there, and before the story ever started, he had been stung by some, I don't know, alien scorpion, whatever it was he stepped on, and he was sick all the way through this book. So I didn't have a robust, strong, alert James Kirk. I had a sick Jim Kirk to deal with. And McCoy, Dr. McCoy, didn't have his medical arsenal with him in his pocket. He couldn't save Jim Kirk's life from this poison sting. And for Jim Kirk, his own life wasn't the problem. He was worried about how his helpless and confused landing party would survive in this primitive environment without him. And he knew they probably wouldn't. It's like the Blue Lagoon after the adults are dead. What's going to happen to these little kids, you know? And that's a problem because he was the galvanizing force in their life and the only one capable of leadership. So that became a dramatic element in the story. It's like my husband and I adopted a little boy from Guatemala who would have died in Guatemala because they don't have antibiotics. Now here, you go down the street to the doctor, you say, give me the prescription, you give the kid the antibiotics, he gets better, he grows up and goes to school, now he's 10. When he came to us, he had severe bronchitis and he was in trouble. He had 6 siblings who died in the mud hills of Guatemala because they just don't have a pill. So what do you do 65 million years back? You can't just give him a shot. So that itself became an element of drama in the science fiction story because the science fiction was what pushed them 65 million years back into this predicament. So all your elements start to come together, and boy, I always make the most trouble I can for my characters. So if I can weaken them in some way, I will. So anyway, we took a scientifically powerful person, and we took away his science powers to see how he would fare. Now, in another book, I know it's here too, it's called Fireship. I think it's there. I took the captain, Catherine Janeway. Well, that series of books was interesting. We kept coming up with new ways to market Star Trek. Because, you know, it's 35 years old. You got to figure out ways to keep it alive. So one of the ways we kept it alive is we did this entire series that was based on old sea stories. And each author picked a different sea story and kind of wrote a book that way. And mine was Captain's Courageous. Well, in Captain's Courageous, you know, the little rich boy falls off his father's ship and ends up being picked up by this fishing schooner. And they're out there for 6 months on the Grand Banks pulling cod and flounder out of the water. I love it. So anyway, he has to learn to adjust to not being a little rich boy anymore, but in fact being a very hard and crusty sailor, because that's what he had to do. Well, in this book called Fireship, I took Catherine Janeway, and I stripped her of all her authority. She always had it easy. She was the daughter of an admiral. She didn't come up through the Starfleet School of Hard Knocks like Jim Kirk did. She was an engineering whiz. She had no problem attaining command of a starship, and to my eye, she was skating through life with everything on her side, so I took everything away. I had her in a little rescue craft when everything around her exploded, and she's drifting off in the middle of nowhere. She's picked up by a salvage operation, and she says to these people, look, I'm the captain of a great, big, glossy, rich starship. If you just take me way over there, and I can do a lot of things for you. And these poor people on this nasty little salvage ship said, that's real nice, honey. Here's a broom. So she started at the bottom, basically where I started on my ship, scraping the hull. And that's where she started. And here she was on this vessel where she knew certain things had to happen. There were dangers coming their way. Of course, they didn't believe her. So she had to work her way up through the ranks again, the hard way this time, in order to get events to bend her way when she had no authority, no power, and nobody believed her. So that was cool. And the cool part was how well she embraced the scrubbing of the deck. You know, she kind of, I used the opportunity to show why she was a captain. A captain doesn't just blow in out of nowhere. A captain is a captain for a reason, and even people who are given the gift of captaincy, if they don't do it well, they don't stick around very long. So we had to explore in this book why she was a captain, because she earned being captain again. And one of the ways she earned it was when they gave her a job like sweeping the deck or scraping the tiles. She did it really well and was determined to do it the best she could. And those are the people who get ahead. it's not necessarily the people who are born with a silver spoon in their mouths or who are born with genius. It's those of us who are willing to sweep the floor better than anybody else. Those are the people that you depend on, you give them the key. So eventually she got the key. I like that story. I like the fish out of water stories. If the characters have command over extreme science, the fun comes when we take the science away and we see how they use their knowledge to prevail. If they have no command over supreme science, then the fun comes when we confront them with it and they have to figure it out. The drama comes when they use their new trick in a way that's never intended or anticipated. The Back to the Future series comes to mind. Caused by science, but not driven by it. Crafted from the end back to the beginning. And motivated by a powerless protagonist who rises to the bizarre circumstances and prevails because of his own personal drive to conquer the conditions. Science fiction is fun, but it has to be good science, and it has to be well-constructed drama, not just a tour of strange things. The best science fiction, as with the story about James Kirk's being divided into good and evil, is that the science provides the story, but it isn't the story. And after watching this, we can look at ourselves and say, I just learned something about myself, and now I'm going to go use it. So thanks for coming. I'm glad to see you out there. Do you have any questions? I covered it all. That happens a lot.
Well, I've said for years, there have been so many attempts at science fiction on TV in my lifetime. Most of them are just absolutely stunning.
That's right.
You defined it pretty well. I always said that if I can't visualize it actually happening, maybe 50 years, 75 or 100 or 2,000 years in the future, then it's not science fiction. I don't want to see it.
That's right. Now, for a while, back when fantasy first jumped to life, yeah, my husband's going to join me. I like that a lot. Back when fantasy was it suddenly blew into the writing world, you could have almost anything published if you had your characters walking around with capes and they had a magic sword. And I'm telling you, this was stupid. They published a lot of garbage until they finally figured out that it's not the capes and it's not the ray gun, it's not the ship and it's not the sword and it's not the big animal at your side. It's the human character who drives the story and what happens to that person and the decisions he makes. My husband, Greg Broder.
Yes, the brilliance is here. Thank you. One of the sort of a corollary to what you're talking about, and Diane sort of touched on this, is that, again, good science fiction, Asimov was great at this, is recognizing how science will affect the human condition. I see a lot of science fiction where these unbelievable scientific advancements, the writers do not understand how that would change the human condition. A good example would be, take from Star Trek, if we really had transporters and if they weren't a very rare thing that only the government or the military could have, how would that change our society? If we all had transporters in our homes, it would be kind of silly to see us riding around in cars. It would change our lives. More to the point, you see in certain science fiction stories where they have...
The holodeck.
They have conquered, yeah, that's a good example. That's another good example. They have conquered the law of supply and demand that's plagued us forever and probably will forever. The idea that you can press a button on a machine and have as much of any material thing as you want ever. That is, there is no want. Now, if there is no want, what happens to our society? Eventually, somebody's got to pick up the garbage. Somebody's got to wash down the walls. And why would anybody? If there wasn't any reason to. And they always kind of gloss over it, and somehow the only characters you ever see are those doing really lofty things. They're doing art, or they're doing this, or they're doing that. But sorry, eventually we're still human. We're going to spill something on the floor, and somebody's got to clean it up, and there's got to be a reason for somebody to do that job, and I don't think it's because they were born to, I just love cleaning up the floor. So if you're going to do a thing like that, you have to start to wonder as a writer, is this going to destroy our society? And some of the early science fiction writers I thought were marvelous at that. I'm lousy with titles. I remember plots, not titles. There was one story I remember about, there was from the main character's point of view, there was a government conspiracy to keep this particular invention and technology a secret. And the technology basically allowed you, I'm trying to remember, it's been so many years, it allowed you to, see certain things, look through walls, do this and that. And the government was tremendously just cracked down. Any people would disappear, all sorts of things, rather than have this technology get out. And they assumed that it was because, people could spy on their military activities and so on. And the protagonist is probably a story of the 60s, when government was evil and bad and everything. And basically the protagonist managed to get hold of the plans for this thing. And it was really rather simple and, a fertilizer bomb. Almost anybody with the right plans could make it in their basement. And he put it out on what in their time was the equivalent of the internet. And boom, it was out there. And there was nothing to be done. Just as the bad guy, government guy, broke through the door. And he said, ha ha, what are you going to do? It's out there. It's too late. And what the guy explained to him was he didn't fully understand what he had just done. That this device allowed you to see through anything at any time, anywhere. There would never again be a moment of privacy in anyone's lives, not in your home, not in your bedroom. It also would see through time. You would be able to see what anybody ever did, what they said, and he painted this horrible, horrible picture of a life where you never, ever had an ounce of privacy, that anyone could look in what you were doing or what you had done at any time. And the story ended with the main character, who was the hero, seeming like, feeling like he had just done the most evil, horrible thing. The writer completely turned around. It was brilliant because the writer recognized the effect on society of certain scientific advancements. Diane mentioned one you see in later Star Trek, and you see it in a lot of science fiction, the idea of holographic images where they become not images, but they become solid. What would it do to our society if you didn't have to go through the struggles and the uncertainties of living life, if you could go, press a couple of buttons, go in a room, and have any kind of reality you wanted, from, being a king of ancient times to having, your own brothel or eating whatever you want or being wherever you wanted, having people you want do exactly what you want, it would be far more addictive than any crack you ever found, and it would cause society to fall apart. But of course, unfortunately, the writers that do these things don't think of that, and they just make it like, well, I'm going to go watch TV for a while. That's very bad writing. That's not thinking through your science. So I have no idea where I started with this,
yeah,
but I've certainly
okay.
gone on with it long enough.
Yeah, but you're fun to listen to.
Yes, the
superpower.
Yes, the
well,
careful what
I
you
mentioned
ask
Superman.
For.
You know, every time he did something, the next comic he had to do something else, and every time he did something, it had to be bigger. There's no limit, and then eventually now, but eventually it's still around because we're still doing Smallville and all that because it wasn't his power; it was how he dealt with it that was ultimate. It's always the character that counts so much more than the trick.
And he always had the opportunity to see it, kryptonite.
Superman
well,
is a
physical. Yeah, he had a physical Achilles heel, which was kryptonite. His psychological Achilles heel was that he can't remember in the movie. He cares about these idiots, He cared about the little weak humans. So you always had one up on him if you didn't care, So and oddly enough, Batman didn't have that because he would go ahead and kill whoever he felt like killing if they deserved it. Superman didn't care to do that. So you have different, superheroes with their own little foibles and flaws, and the dark past. Superman didn't have a dark past. He just wanted a private life, and Batman had a very, very dark past.
Well, isn't that why Superman in the comic was becoming incredibly boring? Because he becomes God at some point.
Yeah. Superman was
a problem.
But, God's not going to make a very good comic.
That's
true. You know what? I'll tell you something funny. I have a degree. I have a master's degree in literature and drama, and one of my most favorite things from my medieval history study of medieval drama is that the advancement of drama through the church and out of the church. Because what happened was the only way that they could communicate the Bible, the Gospels, to an illiterate population was to do it through dramatic. They do drama in the front of the church. You know, they do the quem quaeritas trope, which was, where is my, let's see, where did it go? It was the three women coming up to the tomb, and they would say, where is our Lord? And the angel would say, he is risen, and they would say, alleluia. It was literally a three-line trope. And eventually they started including other characters, like you got Satan. Well, here's Jesus standing there blessing people, and Satan is romping around the sanctuary, declaring things that no human being dares say, and having a ball. And the actors were having fun. Satan was a lot more fun to play. Eventually, they roll this down the aisle and right out onto the church steps, and it goes out into the street, and it's not allowed anymore, and drama is banned in the church. And a lot of that was because Jesus was boring to play, and Satan was fun. So that's absolutely true. You know, you get the characters with the ultimate power, and the ones who are really fun are the not so sweet characters.
But if you mentioned the comics of the 60s, and that you're right, Superman became a very difficult character to do. If you go back to the 40s during World War II, Superman was far more limited. The writers knew that. He was also far less lily white good guy. You know, wouldn't step on a fly. I remember reading some of the very first Superman comics, and of course that were in the middle of World War II, so the Nazis were always the bad guys. And his solution when he caught a bad guy and wanted him to talk was to pick him up by his feet and say, I'm going to smash your head against the wall if you don't tell me. Now, you can't imagine Supi, as the characters evolved over these years, doing that. But Superman suffered from superhero creep, in that if today he can lift a car, well, then the next story, he'll have to lift a bus, and then he'll have to lift a train, and then he'll have to lift a building, and pretty soon you've got this guy with no flaws whatsoever.
Who can push a planet.
And, you know, and that's
And you
that's
don't know where to go from there.
So dramatically, as successful as he's been, Superman isn't a particularly good dramatic character.
Yeah, but he's cute. I have something about that cape. I like capes.
Batman.
I used to run around in capes when I was a kid. I was Zorro.
Batman and a lot of the other
my
superheroes
was
who had limitations.
Confused. I confused my mother a lot.
Your mother is still confused.
Still confused. Can't figure me out at all.
Can we cut that out? I'm kidding.
No, I'm a very confusing little girl when I was a kid, you know. She wanted Princess Grace. She got a deckhand, you know.
What else?
I always wrote. I started writing literally in second grade when I wrote a story about a witch being blown up by TNT, and the class loved it. And just their reaction just took me and went, phew, I can do this, you know. So I wrote my first book when I was 15. It was absolutely crappy, but it had a very redeeming characteristic. It was finished. You have no idea how many novels are begun in this world and are never finished. And until you finish it, you can't learn from it. So I rewrote that book probably. How many times in my life have I rewritten that one dumb book?
And that now was back when you had to chip it into stone,
oh,
by the way.
No, yeah. I mean, I was working on a typewriter with carbon paper and whiteout, and just to create a nice, clean manuscript was a phenomenal feat. Editors in New York could actually eliminate unprofessional writers by looking at the manuscript and just saying, that person doesn't know what he's doing, you know. And if you could just get the format right and supply a tidy manuscript, you were ahead. And I used to struggle for that. And then I'd go to the copy store, and I'd fork up $20 to have it copied. And it was my whole life to have one copy made. You know,
copy technology was fairly new back then.
Oh, and just to have this clean, square copy. And then I'd send it out to New York, and 8 months later it would come back, and it would be, like, bent and crushed and coffee spilled on it. And, oh, God. And I'd have to start from scratch, you know.
You know, I think every writer that we've had has done the same thing. But that question of always written, they always said it.
Well, I was a I'll get there. I was a natural novelist for one thing. I went straight to novels. I didn't do anything else. I've only now written, I think, three short stories because I got asked to. I was just a natural big volume writer. And I wrote on and off for 10 years trying to get published until finally one day he and I were so poor that the only thing we could do was take our dog for a walk. That was our entertainment.
How poor were we?
That was the fun was to take the dog for a walk. So every night we went for a walk. So on one of these walks, here we are in Flint, 25% unemployment, no future, horrible. And he says to me, why don't we turn your talent to the market? And I went, what do you mean? Oh, God. What is this? You know, the writer's reaction we're supposed to have. What, my talent? Prostitute my ability? What? Not be driven by pure inspiration? Well, him says to me, well, those romance novels are selling pretty well. To which I said, you mean those little raggy, those Harlequin, you know, things? And he said, yeah. So I threw up a couple of times, and we went over to the bookstore, and, you know, a Jelly Bean bookstore, and we got about 10 of these used books here. He read 9, and I read half of 1. To this day, I haven't read a whole romance. I've had 6 published. I have yet to read an entire romance of anybody else's work. I only read my own holding my nose. Because I hated it. I mean, 300 pages of I love him, I hate him, I love him, I hate him. We were published within a year. The reason we were published was I started working with Greg. And he began to control my work. We worked scene by scene. I had an excellent editor. He comes up with the plots. We develop together. I write, then he edits. And the books leave the house pre-edited. The key is listening to what the other guy says when he says, you know, this stinks. And then you say, oh, okay, how do I fix it? Instead of screaming and yelling and being insulted. And that's the key. So, you have something to say over there?
Well, I was going to mention, and of course, we have personally posed for all the covers.
That's
true.
My hair was way longer in those days. And
I'm a lot taller and younger than I look.
And blonder. Yeah, but anyway, we were published within a year. We did one cookie-cutter romance, and we immediately went on to very big romances. We did a handful of fair. And we got ahead with this because we were so bored by the genre. We really were not romance writers. We were market writers writing in the market that would sell.
Well, the problem with romances was that our editors would send us books. Say, oh, this is a real good one. You look at this. Try to do this sort of thing. We couldn't tell a good one from a bad one. To us, I mean, my apologies to people that read them. To us, they were all crap.
We
didn't understand
why
anybody read them, so our future wasn't there. In 1985 or 86, I forget.
I'm never going to be able to go back into
Diane
that field
was,
now, you know.
Diane was up at big, big convention. She was up for, she was one of the nominees for the best historical romance of 1998, 1985, 19.
Romance Writers of America, best historical of 1986.
86. I mean, we were in the finalists, and
we were
at this huge convention. There were 500 women there.
Women, and us with an 11-week-old baby.
And me
Greg
holding a
really
little bitty baby.
Popular.
So that was kind of... But, you know, the fact of the matter is we had to smile and nod a lot because we never understood the genre.
And what
never.
Happened was, because we didn't understand it, and because it didn't appeal to us, we made it appeal to us. We created characters who actually went beyond just the I love him, I hate him, I love him, I hate him for 300 pages. And we had these women who would say, would you shut up and get out of my way, please? I've got things to do. And then with this one that almost won the award, our editor calls us and said, well, can you do a gothic? And I gave them my typical answer. Yeah, sure. What's a gothic?
Had no clue.
I had no idea what it was. But my answer to everything, I didn't have anybody gives me work, is sure, I'll do it. I'll just mold it to my level of quality and go from there. So she told me what a gothic was. Is one of these women go along dancing down the moor with the diaphanous gown, and she looks back over her head. There's a light in the tower. You know, and the guy is there, and he's a duke, and he's scary, and he's mean, and he's holding her there against her will.
And there's nothing that bugs these women more than a locked door.
Oh,
they
yeah.
cannot stand a locked door.
So I have her in this situation, except I decided to take the whole genre, I turned it on its ear to make it interesting to me, because I got to live with it for 150, 200, 300 pages. And so I did it, first of all, I did it in first person, which nobody did. That's how I got into Star Trek, too, first person. That was one of the rules I broke. I broke all the rules. And then this Gothic novel, this woman is in this castle, and the man keeps trying to get rid of her, and she will not go. Instead of being held captive, she won't leave. And he keeps trying to kick her out of there, send her away, bribe her, steal her, kidnap her, take her away. She keeps going back. It was hilarious. We put a lot of comedy into it, and all of a sudden, I'm winning an award. I'm just sitting there going, I just don't believe this. I don't know what I'm doing here.
We didn't win, by the way. We were nominated.
We were second.
We were?
Yeah. The only reason we didn't win the first was that it was nominated out of genre because it was a Gothic and not a straight historical. And the only reason it was nominated in that genre was there was no Gothic genre. So, and they told me afterward that that's the only reason it didn't win was technically it was a Gothic and not a historical. So, but everybody loved it. The person who won told me she read it and she threw it across the room because she was mad at it. You know, so it was good. We do well at whatever we do because we just rise to the challenge of whatever that genre is. We don't even understand it. We make ourselves understand it and go with it, you know. But that's because we're market writers. I don't wait for inspiration. I go make it. Usually it's from him.
It also gets back to our personal preference is we would like to do writing that people want to read rather than do writing
that I want to read
that just stays on the computer. Even if it isn't our heart's content, at least we're writing some things. We've liked some of everything we've written.
Yeah, some element
of
everything.
We've never written anything where, well, with possibly...
Some of them are stinky.
We've been hired to do a couple of novelizations of episodes. They pay us a lot of money. It's really fast. And some of them are just terrible, and there's not a word in there that we like.
And the worse the script, the faster I write. I did one in 6 days.
4.5. Diane wrote a book.
It was 5.5 days, 6 counting editing.
I was talking about the writing. I just remember it was just phenomenal.
Five days, yeah. Boy, it was stinking up the house.
It was.
I had to get it out of the house. It was terrible.
And then you have to go to conventions and smile and say, oh, yeah.
Gosh, that was good.
Yep, thank you for saying how good that was. And you want to take these people by the collar and say, why was it good? It
Please,
was not.
Tell me. And then you have the surreal experience, which happened to me one time. I didn't bring the book. It's at home somewhere. I get this book in the mail, and I, honest to God, did not remember having written it. I picked up this book, had my name on it, and I went, what is this book? Well, this book had showed up, on the dock in Detroit, while I was the cook on a tall ship in 98 degrees, Greg shows up with the script and the laptop. I had to get the captain's permission to write this stupid thing while I'm on my ship working, cooking on a propane stove for 22 crew.
What I like is...
I forgot that I wrote it.
They're published all over the world, and you'll get books in foreign languages, and being fairly chimp-like, I only speak one language and not all that well. But I don't understand German, French, Japanese, any of these. But just pick up the book, and you're looking through it, and you see a bunch of things you can't see at all. And then you suddenly see, you know, Diane Carey and then James Kirk. And
well, not only that, but we get one in the mail. It's real little. It's from behind. It's in Japanese. We've been translated now in Japanese. So we gave it to our daughter, who's majoring in Japanese.
Here, by the way.
Here at this university. And she held it up and said, yeah, here's your name, Mom, Diane Carey. She's reading my name in Japanese, you know. And it's been translated into Dutch. And I took a Dutch or a German copy of one of my books to my Dutch captain on another ship. And because I knew I had a Dutch captain, so I took it. And I said, you read German, right? He said, oh, yes, everybody in Holland reads all the other languages because nobody speaks and reads Dutch. So I got brownie points by bringing him a book in German. Because what am I going to do with it, you know? So... Yeah, we've had lots of translations. Those are fun to look at. And I always keep two or three of each for my kids' sake, you know, because they're cute. Or in case I get a Dutch captain, you know, and I need brownie points on the ship or something. So what else can we do for you before we wrap up? Have we covered it all? Yeah, well, we got a big turnout. It's going to be broadcast all over the university.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I still have one question.
Go. Well, my women advice is forget you're a woman. It doesn't matter. It's the characters you create that matter.
Exactly telling you the truth.
You don't. Well, I.
Here's the truth. Diane, be honest with her.
Don't know what you're talking about, so I can't. Go ahead.
If you write as a woman, now remember, nobody who gets your manuscript, there's a name on it, knows who wrote it, doesn't know whether young, old, fat, thin, male or female, if there's a woman's name on it, there are certain markets that you're going to hurt yourself. Seriously. You would be very hard-pressed as a man to break into romance.
Well, that's true.
There are certain...
I thought you were talking about science fiction.
You said, well, even science fiction.
I was talking about science fiction.
Science fiction is actually real good about accepting both men and women. I think you do fine. If you stay in science fiction, you're probably not hurt. If you get out of it, think seriously about whether you want to use a pseudonym or not, because there are certain genres where you won't do as well as a woman, certain genres where you'll have an advantage.
For instance, our Civil War novels.
One of our tragedies.
Yes, our great tragedy. Our best books are our two Civil War novels, Distant Drums and Rise Defiant, by far our best. We unleashed everything we've got. We had no restraining factors. You write in Star Trek, you got to write inside the box. These Civil War novels, we went nuts, and they were great. And some point during the marketing process, the marketing department discovered that D.L. Carey was a woman. I had always written under D.L. Carey when I was a kid. I changed to Diane Carey when I became a romance novelist. And in New York, you don't change that much. They'll lose you. So I just kept it when I moved into Star Trek. But I always wanted to be an androgynous writer, so because I don't write like a woman. You know, I write all sorts of different characters, and they are who they are. So anyway, they found out that D.L. Carey was a woman, so they packaged this book, which has no romance in it, like a romantic women's saga with the guy with his shirt off. You know, and it, now what's now? This is real easy. What are the colors of Christmas? Yeah. What are the colors of Halloween? What are the colors of the Civil War?
Blue and gray,
or red, white, and blue. These books were baby blue and sunshine gold. One of the tricks of marketing books is you have to be able to look across a bookstore and say, "There they are. That's what I want." We know what Star Trek books look like. We know what a cookbook looks like. We know what the romance market looks like. It's right there. I can see it. Well, these books, nobody could tell what the devil they were. So they went into the women's genre romance saga crap instead of the Civil War market, which is where they belonged. Screwed them completely. Were missed. Missed the audience they were written for completely because they found out that D.L. Carey was a woman. And there are other little weird factors that play into this, like, I really don't want female editors anymore, okay? I really don't, because at a couple of major points in my career, when I was about to really launch, my editors got pregnant. No kidding, and
editors
left.
Editors tend to be very young.
And they left.
They burn out by the time they're 30.
Yeah. So we're in the middle of a project, the editor's pregnant, she's gone, there's nobody there to advocate my project, it goes down the tubes, the next editor's favorite project goes up. This has happened to me several times at major turns, and now I'm doing the very chauvinist thing of saying, I want male editors. It's just a fact of life. You know, and as I was saying, in science fiction, I'm right, it doesn't matter that much whether you're a man or a woman, but other markets, men must write with a female pseudonym if they want to publish in the romance field. You know, there are certain other realities. Now, women are breaking into things like the mystery detective field. And
very
they're becoming
nicely.
More and more accepted. So, you know, I don't know. The best advice, I don't have any male, female advice. The best advice is go to the bookstore, look at the books that are like the thing you want to write, and read them. And then call the editors and say, send me your guidelines. And go from there.
So, series books like this actually have guidelines.
Oh, God.
Absolutely. Oh, our contract, you would love our contract with Paramount. They own
my pencil.
They own everything. They own our
my
manuscript.
Notes.
They own our notes. They own
my
our
desk.
Thoughts. I think they own one of our sons.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. They won't repossess him.
Yeah. It's funny.
You want a piece of advice until you get published. Don't have too many principles.
Yeah.
And by that I mean don't say, I just won't do that.
Do it.
There is a huge difference between saying, I'm published and I'm not yet published when you go to New York. It's night and day. It always amazed me. A lot of people have approached us over the years and said, would you read my manuscript? I really want some advice. Well, you know, I get a lot of that. But I used to tell people, okay, I'll read it. I figured a nominal fee, a 250-page manuscript, so I'll read it for and edit it. I'll give you a plot advice and so on for $1 a page. $250 for what'll be a
pretty good analysis
and quite a few hours work. You wouldn't think anything of your plumber charging you. I never had anyone take me up on it. Now the interesting thing, they would go to the University of Michigan and spend 4 years getting a degree in writing.
Forget
but
it.
They wouldn't pay
well,
somebody who is
it, but, you know.
They wouldn't pay somebody who's through, you know, been through the system and gotten things published. They wouldn't invest that last little bit.
And I always ask, why would you spend so much money taking classes in writing from people who have never been published? You know, I mean, find your source and find out what it takes to be published and learn the basic craft of writing. Having a degree in it does nothing for you, sorry.
The they're going to edit that part out.
I know. I'm not saying that you cannot gain knowledge. I'm saying that having a degree in writing does nothing for you when you try to become published.
They're not
having
impressed.
Having been published is the thing that impresses editors. Why? Because a college degree says, I sat through several courses that everybody else sat through. Being published says, an editor trusted me to deliver this manuscript in the amount of time he needed it delivered with the right qualifications so that it could be published on time and marketed in a certain way.
Here's another unfortunate reality for you that will probably surprise you. Computers made it real hard on us. And you think, what are you talking about?
It made me really fast.
Yes, it made us fast, but you know what? Diane talked about having to type out manuscripts and copy and this and that. The physical difficulty, the dedication it took to put out a 350-page manuscript when you had to type and retype and cut and paste, kept a huge number of people that weren't well-motivated out of it. Now anybody with a word processor, because they can put out a nice-looking manuscript, thinks they're a writer, pounds out a few hundred pages and sends it to New York, and New York is flooded
they're
with manuscripts.
Drowning in good-looking crap.
And yes,
and they can't tell unless they read the first 25 pages. And usually it's in the first 25 pages that you go, yikes, and
but it is much harder for an unpublished writer to get published anymore because they get too many. So they say, well, we're not going to read unless you're represented by an agent. Well, the agents say, well, I've got all these other people wanting to read. It's tough. And
yeah,
even once you've been in, there are so many manuscripts out there. They look at you and say, well, why should I pay you what I paid you 15 years ago? I now have the stack of manuscripts over here. It's made the business a lot tougher.
But you're able to make a living at just writing, or do you have other jobs?
I have. Until 3 years ago, that was our exclusive income for both of us, for our whole household and everything. And then he went out and discovered that
I'm getting revenge on the computers. I'm a programmer now.
He's a computer programmer out of nowhere. My husband is one of 9 people out of 250 who jumped through all of the intelligence hoops. You have to have the right kind of brain, the puzzle solving and all that stuff. He jumps through enough hoops to become one of the last 9 people from this big company that they want to train to learn how to program their computers in-house, and there he is. He's one of the IT guys that I haven't got a clue what he even does for a living.
It's my great misfortune that instead of being born rich, I was born really good-looking. So what can you do?
But anyway, he's got this job now.
So why Star Trek?
Well, actually, we were both Star Trek fans, and we were already published. We had 6 books published, which got us in the door anyhow. And we liked it. We're Star Trek people. I mean, I was a sailor. I understood the venue. I know what it's like being in a really enclosed environment with a whole bunch of people. Maybe you don't like them, but you got to depend on them for your life. And I understood it. I liked it. I was raised with a World War II veteran dad, and he and I, one of the things we could do together was watch Star Trek. I was his only son, you know. So we'd watch basically what was submarine drama was what Star Trek was, and it worked great. We used to watch that and combat and all this stuff. So it was a natural, and one day, I don't know how it happened, somebody just said, why don't you try a Star Trek book? And I went, okay. And I really thought, at the time, it was no big deal. It wasn't a big deal. Ballantine had published several books, and they had been bought out by Pocket, and now they were publishing once every 6 months, they were doing a Star Trek book.
No, 6 a year.
I'm sorry, 6 a year, you're right. I knew it was 6 something. So they were doing one every 2 months, and I sent in a manuscript that had, I wrote the first 3 chapters and 1 chapter from later on in the book, and I figured, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to do the same thing everybody else has done, which we've already seen James Kirk's mind and everybody else's mind, so let's see somebody else's mind. So I invented this female, sort of just barely above cadet character, And I stuck her into the situation, and here she's in awe of the main characters. And the trick was that they were all still the heroes. She didn't jump in and become the hero. And I didn't find out until later that this was a no-no, to have a character come up and, you know, upstage the big guys. Except I did it in such a way that she was always one step behind Jim Kirk at every turn. He was ahead of her no matter what happened, and he remained ahead of her in the sequel, too. But it was done in a way that they really liked. And the way they accepted the book was, you've broken every rule we've got, and we love it. It was in first person, and it did all this stuff. And to tell you the truth, they were so whopping successful, they ran to the New York Times bestseller list, and Star Trek was redefined. And they asked us for another one. We wrote another one immediately. It went to the New York Times bestseller list. And for a few years there, we had every book hit the New York Times list, and it was fun. And then Paramount came to a point where they didn't want to break their own rules, and they had a Diane Carey list of what you can't do. So I became the definition of you can't do that, and you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do this. So we went on and played inside the box for a while and did very well with that, too. But it just fit us very, very well. I mean, we're kind of a Kirk and Spock team anyway. Like I said in the thing, I'm always the one who's rushing into the dark, and Greg stops and says, wait a minute, if you go in the dark, you know, this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. And I say, yeah, I know, but it's really cool in the dark, and I want to go in there. And then we just sort of drag each other kicking and screaming in two different directions, and out pops a manuscript, you know, 8 weeks later that's pretty good. And the editors liked us because everything comes out of our house pre-edited. It's already been through the mill because we're not kind to each other. That really stinks. You're going to have to rewrite it. All right, what do you suggest? I mean, our time over the table, we go away from our kids and our phone and sit over the table and work it like a job. And it's a family business. And I don't write in my own blood. I rewrote this entire book from start to finish because the first time through, it wasn't good enough. And our editor called us to say that it wasn't good enough. And our editors in New York go through this all the time, where they have to hold the hands of the writers and say, we need to do this, and let's try to do that. Well, this poor editor called us, and he said, okay, let's talk about the Great Starship Race. He had sent a letter explaining to us it wasn't going to work. And so this was the after-letter call. And I said to him, what's to talk about? I'll rewrite it. And there was just this silence on the other end of the phone. And after a few minutes, out comes his voice going, I have never had an editorial call like this before. I said, well, if it stinks, it stinks. I'm not going to we'll rewrite it. I'm not going to fight for it. And we sat down and took our vacation time and rewrote the whole book. Turned out a great book, by the way.
It's one of our favorites.
It's one of our favorites. You know, but if you cannot change and you cannot be edited and you can't live with it.
Good example of that is we talked to a writer who actually never did make it, very, very published a couple of very minor books and was very indicative, was talking to us about a plot. And the plot had something to do with these alien characters and their blood and this and that. And they were stuck on this dramatic point that was really killing their story. And we pointed out to them where the dramatic point was that was killing their story. So, well, I can't change that because of the alien's blood. And I said, okay. And that was the end of it. And that book never, ever did go anywhere because, well, the alien... So change it.
Change the blood.
Don't say, I've got this thing in here that's killing my whole story. What am I going to do? Take it out. You know.
And this is not to say that I don't occasionally fight for things when I know they're right. That has happened. I have had occasion to spend an hour on the phone with an editor just going, there's got to be some way I can have this. And we go round and around and around and around, and eventually somebody says, wait a minute. Let's do this, and you can have both worlds, but you just got to find the way to do it.
Right, but our arguments are not, if somebody points out why something is anticlimactic or not dramatic, it had to do with that box they make us write in where they say, well, our characters are too pure and kind to do this. And we say, no, they have to do that. That's been more our problems. We
that's
don't
been
argue
tough.
Ferociously.
Yeah.
If
no,
somebody points
don't.
Out to us that one of our plot points or piece of characterization doesn't work, if they make a good point, we'll change it.
Yeah, well, a lot of times the thing about how characters can't lie, ridiculous. It's boring, for one thing. And they did this to us several times through the course of the series. At first, Spock couldn't lie, which was stupid, because during the episode where they established that Vulcans cannot lie, he was lying his face off. when he said that. I mean, that was part of the lie. Well, the genre sort of picked up on this, and they said, well, Vulcans cannot lie. And I'm going, did you watch the episode? He lies. But they picked up on that. And then somehow it translated into all Vulcans cannot lie. I cannot tell a lie. Well, you're an idiot. My son, if you want to kidnap my son, he's in the closet.
Yes.
Give me a break. And then it became Klingons, who also never lied.
Pretty soon, nobody lied.
Only humans are lying. I'm going, you know, we can't do this. We had a whole really good plot line developed. We develop them all before we write them.
I think if you went back now, it'd be only Republican humans can lie.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely true. We did this whole plot line, and it was based on this character's lying and his reactions from his son and all this. And they wrote to us back from California and said, Klingons do not lie. And I mean, you know, you people are just...
What, does their face fall off? What do you mean they can't?
Stupid! So rather than fight with them, we said, okay, and we just changed the whole darn plot so that he didn't lie. You know, it's just silly. And sometimes, I have to tell you, those are the more satisfying moments when you just can't get them to bend and you find a way around it anyway and still make a good story. I mean, the challenge of it, of writing inside the chains that they put around you when you do tie-ins, has its own element of victory when you make it happen and you come out with a good story.
We want
anyway.
You to swim across this pool, and by the way, here's your brick.
Yes. You tie the writer's hands, you throw him in the water and say, okay, swim. Ha ha. And I'll tell you, it's a pain. But it has its intrigues and it has its victories. And somehow that's a challenge. I mean, it's more of a challenge in a lot of ways than just saying to somebody, here's an empty piece of paper, fill it up any way you want. This is a big victory because there are a whole lot of writers who never succeed in Star Trek because of the rules and the pickiness and the marketing and the box. You have to leave the characters the same at the end as the beginning, yet they still have to have an arc. Because you got to leave it the same for the next writer to pick it up. You can't kill anybody. You know they're not going to die. So where do you go? There have to be other challenges. And it's kind of interesting. And boy, well, it raised our kids. You know, so, and it's kind of nice to be trusted with this multi-million-dollar property where when we first started writing, 6 people on the face of this earth were allowed to write it. 6 people. And I think anybody who can say that you are in the top 6 in your chosen field on earth is pretty darn good. I think they're up to 30 a year or something.
Oh, they put out a lot of books.
But we left.
We left. It's definitely seen its day. The marketing,
but still,
the marketing is far down, and
we also need to. You never know. You never know. As far as I'm concerned, a classic is a classic, and you know, Sherlock Holmes never dies. There's no reason for a good, solid character-driven venue ever to go away. And we still have new Star Trek coming around. You know where it is? The movie Galaxy Quest is my favorite Star Trek movie.
That was a while ago.
I love it. It's my favorite Star Trek movie.
Actually,
because
they
it's
did
Star
put
Trek
out a new set of books just
it's,
recently.
It's done with love. It's done with love and respect for Star Trek. And I tell you, I have a ball. I watch that movie over and over. It's just plain good Star Trek. You know, so it's not going to die. It's still around. It had a tremendous effect on all the rest of ship-bound science fiction, you know. And it's still awfully pretty. Boy, my son was watching the old episodes the other day. Of course, for him, it's new.
And by the way, why was it successful? You know, I've always had the theory, if you consider when it was put out in the 1960s, and some of us that are old enough remember the 1960s somewhat.
I do, kind of.
If you look at Star Trek, this is a lot of the science fiction I've read that I don't like and the science fiction I've seen on the screen that I don't like is because I don't want to be there. The Star Trek universe, it was built somewhere that said, despite all our flaws, mankind is all right, we're eventually going to do okay, and the future is somewhere you would want to be. It's not bleak We don't all live huddled under bridges.
It's not post-apocalyptic.
You know,
where
the
where
aliens
the,
haven't
the third,
had
to, the Third World War blew the fingers off all the gloves.
Yes, the aliens haven't had to come in and quarantine us because we're such a horrible species that is a plague on the galaxy. None of that. It said we're all right, and
mankind will go forth and lead in the galaxy.
Although we're not sure of that today.
I don't know. We're privatizing space. Haven't you seen it? Spaceship One. I like
it. What, we hit Mach 8?
Mach 8.
Mach 8 the other day.
And we're privatizing space, and that's where the future is.
That's fast.
Yeah. I like the I like Spaceship One. I was watching. You know, I want to go. How about that? See?
Really?
Solar
I
wind.
Didn't know that one.
Neat.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, we'll get there, you know. We'll get there. It might, I don't know when, but what the heck. At
someday
least
if you ever get your new computer. Diane's dying. Her computer her computer croaked about a week and a half ago. And
it's like I have no legs anymore. No internet, no computer, no, I can't work.
This is a woman who up until about 4 or 5 years ago was still working on a CPM machine.
I was still chiseling on stone.
understand.
I gain new technology only begrudgingly because he forces me.
And then she can't live without it.
And after I reach a certain point, I can't go back. Yeah, that's right. I only got a big screen on my computer. I got a new computer and stopped using the K-Pro because my eyes got bad. I could no longer see the screen.
She only did it because I had to give her a bigger screen, and I couldn't.
And I
her
have
machine.
Only this year managed to switch from WordStar to Microsoft Word for original manuscripts. Finally,
WordStar.
Yeah, WordStar. I'm telling you. See, I know it's silly, but I got to tell you, writers out there, it ain't the technology. It's still you. And your pen, do not rush out and buy the fanciest computer. You don't need it. If you can't make the words come together out of your thesaurus onto a note card, then the computer isn't going to help you. You know, your pink envelopes don't help you get in the door. Good writing gets you in the door.
No, don't try anything fancy out of the ordinary. It makes you look like an incredible amateur. We hear stories about people, well, if you actually put it on yellow paper, they'll notice, or in a blue envelope, say, yes, they notice that you're an incredible amateur. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't act like a desperate amateur.
Yeah, the best way to become a professional is to act and be professional, to listen to criticism about your work and change it. Rewrite. Even when I was teaching college, my best assignments were the ones that the students rewrote. It wasn't the first way through it. I used to teach composition and speech and things like that. It wasn't the first time through. It was the revision was where you learned. Rewrite your own work, for heaven's sake. But let other people read it. How many young writers out there say, oh, I couldn't let anybody read it. Well, you better. I mean, and don't sit there and explain what you meant, because it doesn't do you any good. You can't go to New York with your manuscript and say, but what I meant was this. If you get certain criticism, you better shut up and listen, because somebody didn't understand something. That's a key point. I see a lot of writers just arguing, but I meant this and this and this and that. And I said, well all right, write it down. You know, don't just assume that somebody's going to get it. And you better get used to people reading your stuff if you want to be published. Now, writing can be a great hobby as long as you accept it for what it is. As I said during the original interview, just like skiing is very satisfying, and you don't necessarily have to win a gold medal to enjoy it. Pottery, gardening, painting, anything. If you like doing it, you like doing it. It's good for you. It's good for your soul. It stretches your mind. It advances your skill. It's nice to do. If you're going to suffer that you're not published, then you had better redirect your ambitions and learn how to be a professional writer. Now this is it. I used to, and when somebody asks me to come and speak, I do. I've had occasion to go into classrooms. And occasionally I will go in and talk to kids and all the way up through college and adults, and I've taught teachers how to, you know, read textbooks and judge them and that sort of thing. But, well, now and then I will, you know.
She doesn't have a PhD. Nobody wants to hire her.
Nobody wants me.
Not qualified.
Yeah, well. No, and teaching is not my goal.
Yeah.
It never has been. I don't write to teach. I occasionally teach because I have the writing experience, but it isn't my dream in life. I'm real good at it. I was a good teacher. When I taught at Baker College, I was a good teacher. I still have my students coming up to me and saying, "I remember your class," because I actually taught them how to use a thesaurus, how to put words together, and how to take the most terrifying thing on earth, which is an 8x10 empty page, and fill it up with something that was worth reading. You know, I mean, that's the basic. The trick was that I didn't assume that anybody in my class really liked to write. I was the one who liked to write. They didn't, and I, you know, I always took it from their point of view. I hate to write. What the heck am I going to do with this blank piece of paper? So when I taught, I was good at it, but it's not my dream. And he taught math, the college level. We both were college teachers formerly.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. So anyway, we're on to our new frontiers this year. We have some new projects and new contracts and new things coming up, so we're going to go home and do them. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.